Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
This is in no way surprising, but it is now official. The LA Chargers and Philip Rivers have agreed to mutually part ways. So call that a conscious uncoupling, if you will. In a joint statement, GM Tom Telesco said, quote, "After stepping back a bit from last season, we reconnected with Philip and his representatives to look at how 2019 played out, assess our future goals, evaluate the current state of the roster, and see if there was a path forward that made sense for both parties. As we talked through various scenarios, it became apparent that it would be best for Philip and the Chargers to turn the page on what has truly been a remarkable run. We agreed that making this decision well before free agency would allow everyone to put themselves in the best position for success in 2020. End quote. All right, that's the team side. For his part, Rivers said, quote, "I'm very grateful to the Spanos family and the Chargers organization for the last 16 years. In anything you do, it's the people you do it with that make it special. There are so many relationships and memories with coaches, support staff, and teammates that will last forever, and for that I'm so thankful. I never took for granted the opportunity to lead this team out on the field for 235 games. We had a lot of great moments, beginning in San Diego and then finishing in LA. I wish my teammates and my coaches nothing but the best moving forward." All right, so once again, none of that is surprising. In fact, you could see some of the faint writing on the wall when Rivers did not move his family north from San Diego a couple of years back. And then the writing started to become more and more visible throughout the course of last season when there was even talk of benching the Charger icon. And by the time we got to the offseason, it was pretty much a foregone conclusion that both sides would be looking to move on. That said, while he did not win a Super Bowl with the Bolts, he had a hell of a run with that team. He put up enormous numbers, just shy of both 60,000 passing yards, 400 touchdowns, 8 Pro Bowls, and a lot of bolo ties. 7,300 yard games, 224 consecutive starts, the most by any quarterback not named Brett Favre. An iconic career by just about any metric. And again, no. It did not include a Super Bowl win, but it's not for a lack of effort or for a lack of battling. 6 playoff appearances as a starter. Yeah, probably less than he wanted, probably less than the team wanted, but it included that absolutely ridiculous, epic showing in the AFC Championship game back in the day in Foxborough when he took the field with a torn ACL and meniscus. I mean, that was the very definition, the very epitome of toughness and badassery. And not only that, but he came back 100 days later after surgery and was ready in time for minicamp. So it tells you everything you need to know about Philip Rivers, that his greatest game was not that 500-yard game against Green Bay. It was not the comeback against Kansas City in 2018. It was the loss to the Patriots in the AFC Championship game, because he knew how close he was to the Super Bowl and he wanted to give it everything he had and more than anybody pretty much could. And he did so. Came up short, but he put it all out there. And my man talked a lot of trash. Not just trash, but clean trash, which is not easy to do. In fact, it makes it even more awesome. Detroit Lion corner Darius Slay and I talked about that on Radio Row.
We walking through the tunnel. I'm just minding my business, dapping up my teammates. I heard him yell out my name, Slay. In the tunnel. So I turn around, and he's like, "Yeah, early and often, Slay, early and often." I said, "Oh, no." So I went to my one of my safeties, Quandre Diggs. I'm like, "Hey, man, we got to go right now. He done talked to crazy, and we got to get right."
What's your reaction when old man Philip Rivers is like, "Yo, Slay, early and often, early and often.
It made me laugh because the fact that how he said
it. You got to respect that,
man. I respect it the best because he wants you to bring your best out of you, so he trying to mess with your mind a little bit. But for him not to cuss and say it, it was going to make it even funnier because I probably would have cussed.
But he doesn't, though.
He doesn't. That's what makes it so funny.
That's so funny that he could talk that kind of junk without cussing.
Yes, he talked a lot of it.
Every play.
Keenan caught a pass on me, and now, you know, he driving down the field, walking down. I'm just getting up, walking. I heard him say, "Yeah, early. Yeah, I told you. Yeah." Like, I was like, "Ooh,
you know what's funny about that, aside from that, is they let me on the air sounding like crap like that. Now that's funny. If you want further evidence that it really is possible to talk junk cleanly, here is further evidence.
Dadgummit!
Golly!
Unstinking believable! That's horse mess.
Just because he keeps it clean, though, does not mean he will not get nasty. He will. And he will give you some horse mess.
Oh, quit crying! Quit crying! You talking the whole game, now you're on mute!
Quit crying! Quit crying! You're talking the whole game, and now you're on mute. Philip Rivers. And he'll let you know that he knows what's up and that you don't.
Hey, I can just tell you right now, 57's firing. He's the new Clowney. 41's the mic. God. Told you. Hey. You don't play Mike. Why would you line up there? Quit just making up alerts. You're like, you hear things, you scream. Reverse. You don't know what's coming.
You don't play Mike. Why would you line up there? Like he knows your job better than you know your job, and he's going to let you know it. And, of course, there was this verbal magic from this season against the Jags.
He's going for a 90-yard touchdown! 90-yard touchdown!
Hey, Sam, too. You see, I ain't talking, right? Stay humble, bro.
But you know he's right.
Stay humble. Stay humble, cuz.
I can say 90. I can be excited.
Yeah, but don't do that by my ear. Don't do it by my ear. No,
I will do it by my
ear.
No.
Hey,
that's what I do.
1-7.
That's what I do.
I holler at you after the game. 17, just keep talking.
That is incredible. You have to see the video of that to fully appreciate that. Hey, 17, stay humble. Hey, 17, 1-7, you keep talking. I'll see you after the game. Philip Rivers gets up and he's screaming, 90-yard touchdown. 90-yard touchdowns. Yeah, but don't do it in my ear. I will do it in your ear.
90-yard touchdown!
Touchdown! Stay humble, 1-7. See, like, that's not just Rivers talking trash. That's Rivers talking trash to an opposing player who is kindly helping him off the ground. And as he's being helped up, he's barking the entire time. And he's barking cleanly. There is only one Philip Rivers. Like, I could do an entire three-hour show of Philip Rivers talking junk and horse mess, doing it clean, and it would be awesome.
That's horse mess.
But you know what? If you did that, though, it would overlook all the other things this guy's done. So even though it was clear this was coming, and it was a matter of when, not if, Rivers and the Chargers were going to go their separate ways. We knew this. It's still weird not to think of him with the Chargers. It is still nearly impossible to see this guy in somebody else's uniform. I mean, it'll be weird now. Weird as hell. Dadgummit.
Dadgummit.
How weird would it be to see Philip Rivers with a horseshoe or a pirate flag on his helmet? Dadgummit.
Dadgummit.
So weird. And yes, he does want to continue to play Dadgummit.
Dadgummit.
And there are going to be other opportunities out there. Maybe in Indy with Frank Reich. Obviously, they've got a good relationship. Maybe with the Titans, who are not that far from where he grew up. Dadgummit.
Dadgummit!
There's been suggestions even that maybe Tampa Bay, if they decide to move on from Jameis Winston. Maybe even Jacksonville, if they're not convinced that Gardner Minshew is totally ready. So there are going to be places to go, and as rough as last season was, and yes, there have been signs of decline. I know you don't want to hear that, Phil. Dadgummit!
Dadgummit!
There have been some signs. That said, it would not surprise me at all to see this guy light it up for another year in the right situation. But it doesn't mean that it won't be bizarre, because it will be. This guy is a Charger through and through, even if he does not end his career with them. So it's been an amazing ride with the Chargers, Phil. You've been all class. You did everything within your power to deliver that franchise and that city, San Diego, not Carson. The ultimate trophy. I respect the hell out of it. I respect the hell out of you. I'm going to miss that guy in SoCal. But I am anxious to see where he lands and what he does next and where he runs that clean brand of smack. Like your hat says, big dog, now you begin.
Dadgummit.
Anybody have any final thoughts? He wants to play.
90-yard touchdown!
Gotta love that exchange so much. 90-yard touchdown! Stay humble.
Stay humble, cuz.
Stay humble, cuz. It is so great. A defensive player is telling him, hey, man, come on, man. He's like, what? I'm excited.
Just don't say it in my ear.
I will say it in your ear. 90-yard touchdown. He is Tom Haberstroh. Tom, good to have you back. How are you?
Good to be back, Jim. How are you doing?
Great, Tom. Great to have you back. Let me start in the East. I'll get right to it. Tom, if I had said to you before the season that the Miami Heat would be making big moves at the trade deadline and right in the thick of the battle for the third or maybe even the second seed in the East, if I had said that before the year, you would have said what?
Man, I was banging the over on the Miami Heat win total before the season because I just think Jimmy Butler was a perfect fit. With Pat Riley and Eric Spoelstra, the DNA of the Miami Heat, all about hard work, all about work ethic, gym rats, up and down the organization. And I just felt like this was a team that if Bam Adebayo and Tyler Hero and all these youngsters could really fit their roles, and Duncan Robinson, if they could fit their roles, this would be a team that could crash the East party. And that's exactly what they're doing. They arm up with Andre Iguodala and Jay Crowder. And it looks like to me that Milwaukee Bucks might run away with the East right now, but I definitely know that they are going to be scared to face the Miami Heat because they have the right mix of veterans, the right pedigree with the coaching staff and the organization, and they have this upside with their young players. Bam Adebayo, a 22-year-old all-star this year, one of the great young stars in the league. They've got the great mix that can take down anybody in the league over a few games, over a seven-game series. Man, I would not want to face the Miami Heat, even when we're talking about the Milwaukee Bucks, you know, on their like 70-win pace right now.
Tom Haberstroh joining us. I would agree with everything you just said. And when you mentioned guys like Butler and Iguodala, Crowder, Adebayo, especially defensively in the postseason, Tom, what about Iguodala? Like, a lot of people have their opinions about how he handled his time in Memphis. Well, actually, not his time in Memphis, since he never really was there. What do you make of how that entire situation went down and how he handled it?
This is such a minor story to me. Like, both sides agreed to this, Jim. This wasn't like Andre Iguodala was stiff-arming the organization. The organization didn't want to have this guy who didn't want to play for them either. It was a mutually agreed-upon decision to have him stay home because they were going with the youth movement. And, yes, Andre Iguodala probably could have helped the Memphis Grizzlies, but make no mistake about it, Jim. This was a mutual decision. And for Andre Iguodala to get to catch the heat for this, no pun intended, it's ludicrous to me. I think it's a minor story that only came about when Ja Morant and Dylan Brooks tweeted about it and commented after that game recently. And look, they should be. I think it's great. I think it's great that these youngsters are calling out Andre Iguodala. I would feel the same way. But to make, you know, to point fingers at Andre Iguodala or point fingers at the Memphis Grizzlies for mishandling the situation, I think it's a total non-story. Look, Andre Iguodala is 36 years old. Most players with that kind of decorated career are out of the league by now, you know? So the fact that he's willing to sit out, get his body in shape for his next chapter, the next team, I feel like people are living in the past. This is the new NBA. You know, this is a different climate. This is a different landscape where players are exerting their power and exerting their recognition that, hey, teams would fall over to find Andre Iguodala a championship team. And so Andre Iguodala was smart. It was kind of, different. We don't see these holdouts a lot in the NBA. You might see it in the NFL in training camp, or you don't see it in the NBA. But Andre Iguodala, to me, he's a future Hall of Famer. I wrote a column last year in the summer detailing how when you consider his finals MVP, the fact that he's such a good defensive player, and the fact that he won gold medals in the Olympics, this is a guy who, as Steve Kerr called him, a great amplifier, the best amplifier since Scottie Pippen, a guy who makes everyone around him better, like Scottie Pippen did for filling in holes wherever he was asked. And I think that's a legacy of Andre Iguodala and why the Miami Heat went after him so hard, is he makes everyone around him better. He doesn't have to shoot it 20 times a game. He's going to guard the opponent's best player. He's going to play make. He's going to play hard. And I think that's perfect for what the Miami Heat do. And I think they are going to be a really difficult out in the playoffs because of Iguodala.
Tom Haberstroh is joining us for a few more moments. Tom, you mentioned Milwaukee. Now, they did not make a move at the deadline, but they did add Marvin Williams yesterday. As we go to the All-Star break, are the Bucks the favorites to win it all at this point?
I think you got to put them as the favorites. I think the Los Angeles Lakers are vulnerable. Same with the Clippers. We just haven't seen enough from Paul George and Kawhi Leonard to put them over the top. I mean, I think Vegas right now has the Lakers as the favorites, but I would say, you know, Milwaukee Bucks, this feels a lot like the 2014-15 Golden State Warriors, where people just didn't want to believe that they were this capable. We didn't see Stephen Curry win a title yet, so we couldn't believe that they were able to do this. The 2014 Golden State Warriors. But this is a situation where Giannis is that good. He is that revolutionary player like Stephen Curry was. And we didn't see Klay Thompson and Draymond Green ascending to that status like we know them now. And it kind of feels like we're seeing that with Chris Middleton and Eric Bledsoe now, where, you know, are these guys stars? Well, we wait until we see it in the playoffs. Milwaukee is winning and blowing teams out at a level that we haven't seen in a long time. So to me, until the Lakers add another ball handler to complement LeBron James, I still think that the Milwaukee Bucks are at this point where you can't say that they're not the favorite.
Tom Haberstroh joining us. And then, of course, Tom, you've got that Andrew Wiggins, D'Angelo Russell trade. You know, when you look at Wiggins, I'm just going to cut right to the chase. Why is it not, and we've seen flashes, but why has it not worked out so far for him? For instance, was it him being in a bad situation? Is it Wiggins himself? Is everybody else just wrong about him? What is the story with him and where he is in his career right now?
I think back to before he got his max contract, Jim, when the owner of the Minnesota Timberwolves, Glenn Taylor, reportedly handed him the max contract and said, before you sign this, I want you to commit to giving more defensively, to having a higher motor defensively, to being a more all-around player. And Jim, if you got a $100 million contract sitting in front of you and all you have to do is say, yes, I'll do that, to sign it, come on. Like, you're signing that piece of paper.
You bet.
And I think that's the thing is Andrew Wiggins was drafted number one overall. He was rewarded with a max contract. And now he goes to the championship pedigree Golden State Warriors. I think the light hasn't turned on because the light has been turned on for him. He's been given the number one pick, given the money, and I think it's been enabling for him. You know, for him, I don't understand the people that say he's going to change in Golden State because he has been asked to change so many times over his career, and he just hasn't. And so I think if he wasn't the number one pick and he wasn't a max player, I'm not so sure he'd be a starter in today's league because it hasn't been a winning player on both ends of the floor. He's one of the worst defenders at his position. And yes, he fills a positional need, but so did Glenn Robinson III that they traded for a second round pick. He was a positional need, but they needed to get rid of D'Angelo Russell apparently. And Andrew Wiggins was the only player that they could identify at the small forward position that would make it work.
Now, Tom, I mentioned the Haberstroh podcast. You are doing a live Haberstroh podcast in Chicago Friday at noon. For those who have never been, what is a live Haberstroh like?
Oh, man, it's awesome. It's going to be, we're going to have lots of special guests at the event on Friday. It's going to be just a celebration of the Chicago Bulls and former players. And faces of the Chicago Bulls will be there. It's going to be at the High Line at noon in Chicago. I'm really excited to be indoors, Jim. I don't know if you saw, but it's going to be minus 20, minus 10 wind chill on Thursday night going into Friday. So I got to bundle up here. I got to go and pack up, Jim.
Tom, I understand this. Like, I was at the AFC Championship game, and it's like, hey, Rome, can you stop talking about that? No, because I was outside at the AFC Championship game and before the game. I was not outside the entire game. I'm still not right. I understand exactly what you're saying, Tom. Bundle up, get indoors, stay indoors. So, yes, I get it.
Oh, man. Why can't we do what the NFL did and just put it in Miami? Like, let's make the event. Oh, let's switch it to Miami or New Orleans or Houston. Let's do it.
Black Monday in the NFL. Black Monday, when I say that, you know what I'm talking about. It's the Monday after week 17 of the regular season where coaches and GMs who fail to deliver on expectations get their walking papers. So we know what Black Monday is. Apparently in the XFL, Black Monday is after four quarters of bad football because after allowing 37 points to the Houston Roughnecks in week one of the regular season. Pepper Johnson already iced as the LA Wildcats D coordinator. I mean, damn. An ibuprofen for Peppa. A totally where were you when moment. Where were you when the XFL brought the hammer down and fired its first coach? Coordinator. And not just any coach, though. Pepper Johnson, right? My man's got a Super Bowl ring for every digit on one of his paws. Two as a player, three as a coach. But apparently, a fistful of jewelry at the highest level is not enough to keep you in the XFL for more than a week. At least not with your current employer. But you want to talk about a cutthroat business. You want to talk about a ruthless business. Hell, the old Dallas Cowboys head coach got an entire decade to do like virtually nothing except clap on the sidelines before he ultimately met his maker. Pepper Johnson got what? An entire game? In the XFL. And did I mention, my man's got five Super Bowl rings. So if you're not taking the XFL seriously yet, just know the LA Wildcats sure as hell are. In fact, probably a little too seriously. Who the hell gets canned after one bad game? One bad game. The first game. I mean, like, were there a bunch of Wildcat fans taking to the streets, calling for this guy's gig after that shellacking from H-Town? I don't think I would know. I live here. This town barely takes NFL football seriously. I can't imagine how badly they want to see somebody fall on the sword after a single XFL game. I mean, personally, and again, I'm keeping an open mind and I'm paying attention, but I'm still getting used to the fact that the media actually covers the XFL, that there are actually XFL highlights, that there's actual XFL news. And now we've got statements about the dismissals. Not only did it go down, but there are statements that have to be read on the program. As an example, head coach and GM Winston Moss said, quote, "While these decisions are difficult, we have given this significant thought. We thank Pepper for his contributions to the Wildcats, and we are looking forward to our home opener this weekend." End of quote. We've given this significant thought? Sure you didn't, Winston. Firing somebody after one game does not sound like significant thought. It sounds like the exact opposite of significant thought. I mean, never mind how bad it looks to fire a guy after only one season, right? This dude got smoked after one game. If firing a coach after one season is admitting a mistake, what the hell is firing a guy after one game? Panic much? If that sounds like a panic move, if that sounds like an impulse, it sounds like anything other than, quote, significant thought. Man, you cannot believe how much thought we gave to this. You cannot believe how many sleepless nights there were over this. You can't believe how many times I had to turn this over in my head before I finally decided I have to do this. Carlos Beltran can't believe how quickly Pep got the axe. And did Moss really just say that he, quote, wanted to thank Pepper for his contributions? What contributions? Those four quarters that you allowed him to coach? This guy was there for a cup of coffee before you snatched it out of his hand and told him to find his own damn Keurig.
Put that coffee down.
Pepper.
Coffee's for closers only.
Surprised he didn't hit this guy with a, hey, yo, paprika, get the hell out of my office. You call yourself a D coordinator, you son of a bitch. Beat it, Salt.
Bench the salt.
Get out of here, Paprika. Come on, dude. He's Pepper Johnson. He's got five rings. I'm not saying the guy gets a lifetime gig, but maybe, I don't know, a second game? Man, what a weird statement, too, after a weird move. I guess the Wildcats, man, they're pretty hell-bent on running the table. And after that didn't happen, somebody had to pay the piper. Somebody was getting rolled up, and that somebody was Pepper Johnson. I guess 5 Super Bowl rings and a badass name do not guarantee you jack in the XFL. Look, I understand that coughing up 37 in a loss is not a great day at the office. Except the Miami Dolphins, an example. Their D coordinator last year, Pat Graham, did that 4 different times. He kept his job. And then he got hired by the Giants last month to do the same thing for them. I guess it turns out you have to rail lines of blow on camera and send it to a Vegas stripper to get fired from the Dolphins coaching staff. Yeah, but go ahead and give up 37 as many times as you want. I would tell Pepper to send a resume to the Dolphins, but they've already filled that vacancy. The question now is, who are the Wildcats going to fire next week if they can't handle the Dallas Renegades? Then it's not going to be long before Winston Moss, the GM, is looking at Winston Moss, the head coach. Because at the rate that they're toe-tagging staffers, it's only a matter of time before they get to the guy in charge. Hell, Moss may not let Moss even get off the field at halftime before he breaks him off. It's not a great day for Pepper, obviously. But you know who else it's not a great day for? Bill Belichick and his coaching tree. Belichick has a coaching tree that now includes Bill O'Brien, Romeo Crennel, Charlie Weiss, Eric Mangini, Matt Patricia, and some dude who got fired after only one game in the XFL. It's a bad look for Pep, but a much worse look for the hood. Now you think you hate Mondays. You think you hate your boss. Yeah, try being Pepper Johnson. I'll tell you to pour one out for Pep, but it looks like the Wildcats already did it. Damn. They ain't playing in the XFL. How about that whole thing, too, that everybody in the XFL is going on and on about, man, we're just trying to get back to fun. Football's supposed to be fun. We're trying to have fun. Fun? This dude got fired after one game. One game? You can see where it used to be, you always got 3 years if you were a head coach. And then all of a sudden, 2 years. And then guys were getting fired after only 1 year. And now in the XFL, one game. How long before guys are getting fired at halftime? How long before somebody gets fired after a bad first series? How long before somebody gets fired after losing the coin flip? How long before a coordinator gets broken off during the pregame stretch? Yo, man, I don't like the way you're walking around. I don't like the way you're talking to players. You're fired. Wait, what? During the pregame stretch, I'm fired? Yeah, man. Beat it, Paprika. Hit the bricks, Basil. Hey, Pepper, I'm on your side, man. I don't get this twisted. I want this getting back to you like I didn't have your back, because I do. I'm just saying, the way they're handling this, Winston Moss, too, a guy who played in the league for a long time, the way he handled that, and again, I'm not there. I don't know what happened. I probably should preface the entire take by saying I don't really know what happened. If he got fired because they allowed 37, or maybe there's some so-called philosophical differences that they didn't know about when he was hired. I'm just saying, if you're going to treat a guy like that and disrespect a guy who's got 5 rings, would you put it by him to say, yo, Basil, hit the bricks? They fired the guy after one game. It wouldn't surprise me. I could see it. Yo, Lemon Pepper, get out of here, man. Which is where I'm going to start with him. Jason Lockenfora joins us. Jason, good to have you back. How are you?
Always good to chat with you, my friend. How are you?
Same. Great, great. Good to have you back. I want to start right here. You had your first full weekend at home since July, JLC. Yeah. How was it, and how did you and the family spend it?
It was good. Pretty low-key. Took one of my kids to go see a major, I don't even know what it's called anymore. It used to be the MISL, I don't know, the Indoor Soccer League, Baltimore Blast against the Rochester Lancers. So we did that on Saturday. Sunday, my other son had a basketball game. Just ran around, you know, went to breakfast with the kids, slept in my own bed on a Friday and a Saturday night. It was a good thing. I'm always happy for it. Didn't see that much of the XFL, but I'm sure I'll have plenty of time to catch up on that.
All right. Were you able to sleep in at all? What time did you wake up?
Oh, I mean, 7:30-ish. So, not no, bad. You know, I may not have slept 8 one day. But, I mean, that's whatever. It's all good.
I
figure, you know, once they're all in college, I'll sleep.
JLC joining us. Exactly right. Now, I want to get to your plan for the Bengals in 1 minute, but you and I have been talking about Philip Rivers and his status with the Chargers for months now. How weird is it then? Is it going to see, if this is what it comes to see him in another uniform next season? And if you had to say right now, what is the most likely destination?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it will be odd. He's got such a unique throwing motion, right? Like you conjure an image of Philip Rivers, and it doesn't look like anybody else with the javelin throwing, and he's always had the lightning bolt right over his shoulder while it looks like he's throwing the javelin. So it'll look different, but I mean, you know, I can remember Joe Montana as a Chief. You know, this stuff, it you know, it tends to happen. Peyton Manning as a Bronco, et cetera. I think Tampa or Indianapolis, Jim. We probably talked about it all the way back in November when I started hearing that it was very unlikely that Rivers would be back with the Chargers. Indianapolis, they've made it clear there that they're not beholden to Jacoby Brissett, and obviously their head coach, Frank Reich, is very familiar with Rivers from having coached him with the Chargers. And, you know, the Bucs are doing a dance right now with Jameis Winston, and maybe that ends up with a tag of some sort, or maybe it ends up with some sort of creative deal. If it doesn't, though, for where Bruce Arians is at this stage of his career, frankly, this stage of his life and all the health battles that he's fought, I don't know that he's looking to break in some second or third round quarterback on a 3 or 4 year plan. I think with the weapons they have on offense, Philip Rivers, he still wants to push the ball downfield. He's got that swashbuckler in him that Bruce Arians, you know, pretty much demands. It might be a fit.
Jason Lockenfora joining me. Now, you've made the point, Jason, that the Chargers could do a lot worse than signing Tom Brady and still drafting Justin Herbert. How likely is it that they take that route?
I mean, look, they're both very real avenues for them. Tom Brady, and again, we've been talking about this on the NFL Today since November, he's very open to the possibility of playing for the Chargers, and there aren't that many scenarios outside of Foxborough that get the wheels spinning with, you know, team TB12, but that is certainly one that does. For the geography, the creature comforts, the weather, the fact they've already had a mansion in Malibu, the fact that he spends off seasons throwing at USC anyway, Tom House, his throwing guy, is there, Alex Guerrero, his trainer, is there, all his Hollywood buddies are there, his post-playing career is likely going to be in Hollywood and Tinseltown as a movie mogul producer, something involved with the media. We all saw his cryptic Netflix commercial right around the Super Bowl. I mean, it's not a you don't have to guess what his second career is going to be. It's going to be something involved in the media, and where better to be, or Hollywood production, whatever, than right there in this beautiful $4 billion odd, you know, dollar football Taj Mahal that Stan Kroenke's building. So, you know, if they approach this the right way, and if the Chargers roll out the red carpet and do some un-Charger-like things in terms of wooing a guy like Tom Brady, they've got a real shot.
Jason Lockenfora, my guest. All right, so going back to the other point then, that all makes so much sense to me. If the Chargers were to sign Brady, do you think that he would be okay with them using the first pick on a future quarterback, or would he be pushing them to use it on a player that can come in and help immediately?
I mean, look, in a perfect world, you're getting more help because it's only a couple years for Brady. But I've talked to enough people close to him who say he recognizes this for what it is. It's his last bite at the apple. This is his, you know, whether it's Foxborough or somewhere else, he's got a couple of more years left, and then it's obviously over for good. And part of his legacy, he wants to be tied to leaving whichever franchise he goes to in a good place and not having them being left in the lurch and helping develop this quarterback, whoever the young guy may be. And does this TB12 stuff, the training regimens, the avocado ice cream, could that work for somebody else as well? He thinks it can, and he's obviously completely devoted to that mindset. So I don't think you'd have any questions about, oh, is he going to be passive-aggressive, or which Tom's mindset going to be. It's going to be about helping this next guy be ready to take over when he leaves. So, yeah, I think he would totally understand the situation. And you know, he's 43 years old. That is what it is. Father Time only goes in one direction.
All right, JLC, what about your plan for the Bengals? Now, you've got a piece up right now on CBSSports.com where you break it all down. They've got the top pick. Joe Burrow is right there, but there have been some hints and some rumblings that maybe he does not want to go to Cincinnati. First of all, if you're a Bengals fan, how much should that worry you?
I mean, it should worry you because ownership there, Mike Brown is a throwback guy, and he can be pretty stubborn, and he can be pretty ornery, and he's got a mindset of what, you know, draftable players should be like, and we've got all the control and they don't, you know, but the reality is it's not as cut and dry as that. Ask Phillip Rivers and Eli Manning. So, yeah, the scenario is a little different under this collective bargaining agreement, but you can still rattle some chains and make things be known if in fact Burrow isn't comfortable with the Bengals as we get closer to the draft. The reality is that they could approach this a couple different ways and still have a potentially good quarterback for this year and have options open for the long term as well. I mean, they have to trade Andy Dalton. They should have benched him a week before they did and traded him at the deadline. But regardless, could you get a 2 or 3 for Dalton? I don't think it's out of the question. Rosen went for a 2 last year. And then can you use that draft collateral along with the first pick you already have in the second round and the first pick you have in the third round to then go throw 3 or 4 picks at a Cam Newton, knowing if Newton plays well, then you could always franchise him and trade him and get another haul, plus the haul you're getting to move out of first overall this year if you do get a caretaker like Newton. And now you're in position to get Lawrence the following year or move up and down the board however you like. And if Cam Newton is healthy, you can tag him and continue with him and keep building assets around him with the haul you'd get for first overall. I mean, look, when Washington moved up from, what, 7 to 2 to get RG3 in 2012, it was 3 ones, a 2, and a 3. You could get more than that in this scenario, somebody going to 1 for Burrow. So if I'm the Bengals, I'm being a realist about this, and I'm keeping all my options open. But saying all that, this is also the team that pretended the trade deadline didn't exist. So I'm probably, you know, talking into the abyss here. But if they were a little bit creative and a little bit progressive, they could really flip the league on its ear this offseason.
No, I think that's really thought-provoking, what you lay out there. You did a really good job of laying the entire thing out. Now, if they did all that, JLC, if they took your advice and they got that boatload of picks and that haul of draft choices, how much confidence would you have that they would actually do the right thing with all of those assets?
Well, I mean, you're not going to hit on all of them. I mean, I think history would show us in a lot of these trades those picks don't always turn into players, right? I mean, the Browns sat on a ton of picks, didn't do much with it. Go look at the return for the RG3 trade in terms of what the Rams got. It didn't turn out to be what you would have hoped. But I like, you know, volume can't hurt, right? If we're throwing darts, the more darts you can throw, the better chance you have that some land somewhere near that bullseye. And that could be a team that's not – I think offensively they have the potential to be kind of interesting sooner rather than later. And if you could pump all those draft picks into the defense, who knows, man? It doesn't have to take forever. But again, we're probably wasting our breath.
All right, so Jason, before you go really quickly, for all the attention being paid to Tom Brady and the Pats, the Saints have got a quarterback situation of their own, starting with the fact that Drew Brees is reportedly considering retirement. What is your sense as to where his head is on that, and what kind of a timeline is he using to announce his decision?
I mean, he's absolutely. I mean, he's not pulling any punches. He's made it clear publicly and privately that he needs to sit on this in a way he never has before, and he's said, I want to take a month to make this decision. I've never heard Drew Brees speak like that before. Drew Brees had always been basically mimicking Tom Brady's talking points, which are, my mind feels great, my body feels great, I think I could play till I'm 45. That's not where Drew Brees is right now, and the fact that he's gone down this road already in so much as being willing to at least say, I'm going to need a good period of time here to make a decision, that tells me that there's probably a pretty good chance that he's done. You know, and where does that leave the Saints? You've got Teddy Bridgewater, who you can try to retain. I don't think they can keep him and Taysom Hill. And I know that Sean Payton thinks Taysom Hill can win in this league. He might have to do it a little bit differently than what we're accustomed to, and certainly differently than how they did it with Drew Brees. But he feels like that's an impact football player that has more to be called out of him. So, yeah, this is going to be a crazy offseason, bud.
He is an NFL insider for CBS Sports and CBSSports.com. And, of course, you can watch Jason Lockenfora every Sunday on the NFL Today during the regular season and the postseason. JLC, thank you so much. Great to have you back.
Always my pleasure, buddy. Talk to you soon.
Because yesterday, the NFL's Instagram account posted a breaking news photo with the caption, Philip Rivers to enter free agency after 16 seasons with the Chargers. And then the post was liked by, wait for it. Actually, you don't need to wait for it because you already know. It's that desperate pub hound, Tom Brady. He was all over it. That's right. Troll Brady liked the post because, of course, he did. And he knew exactly what he was doing. You know what that was not about? That was not about Troll hyping Phil. That was not about Brady hyping Rivers or praising him for an incredible run that he had with the Chargers or showing respect to a fellow gladiator for the great battles that they've had over the years. That was not about that at all. That was about Brady trying to rip the spotlight for himself. If you wanted to praise Philip Rivers, there are like a million different ways to do it. Liking that post was not one of them because that's not what that was about. It was about liking the fact that the Chargers are going to need a new quarterback, perhaps. About Brady thinking, oh, no, they're not going into a new stadium with Tyrod Taylor. Oh, hell no, they're not. No, what that was Brady trying to remind everybody that he is going to be a free agent and that he really might be done in New England. And one of the places that he might really think about going to is L.A., you know, because Brady, your child might have forgotten this, he's a native of California. He's from California. You know, and the Chargers make sense, right? He's from California. They're going into a new stadium. They need a quarterback. They've got a really good wide receiver, something he does not have in New England. And they really, really want him. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, we know that. We know you're going to be a free agent, Tom. You know how we know that? You've told everybody like a million times. You won't let us forget. We know. It was interesting for maybe 5 minutes. Now it's just sad. Now it's just pathetic. You're the worst kind of desperate, Tommy. It's a terrible look, and you don't even know it. What is this guy even doing on Instagram in the first place? I've said it before. I'm going to say it again right here. Brady was so much cooler before he started to actually be himself and let everybody in. Before I knew anything about the guy, there was nobody I would rather smash a cocktail or five with. Now you couldn't pay me to do it. Yeah, Rome, Tom Brady's on the phone. He wants to hang out. Yeah, no. No. I mean, take a look at yourself, Trolley. You're spending your offseason on Instagram, liking posts about transactions from other teams. I mean, damn, dude. I would tell you what I tell everybody else who is pissing their entire life away on Facebook and Instagram. Man, get a life. Seriously. Get a life. Tell that guy to get a life. Am I right, Jim Harbaugh?
Tell that clone to get a life.
Man, spend some time with your family. Travel. Unplug. Read a book. I don't know. Get in the gym. Work on your pliability. Man, just put your freaking phone down, dude. Do something. Anything aside from just sitting around trying to come up with new ways to make everything about you and your impending free agency. Because constantly banging away at that does not make you look cool. It's certainly not driving up your price. Your value as a quarterback is in the rings and the wins, not the posts and the likes. All this does is make you annoying. Although after all this junk, I'm having a hard time imagining how it could be any more annoying than it already was at this point. I mean, hell, if I'm a team that's not the Patriots, or even if I am the Patriots, I'd be asking myself, is this dude going to be in his new playbook? Or is he going to be in his iPhone all damn day, every day? You're Tom Brady. You're regarded as the greatest quarterback of all time. That's your resume when it comes to free agency. That's it. You don't need anything else. You don't need to hype yourself any more than that already. You don't need to remind anybody of what you've done. And most of all, you don't need to be acting like we're hanging on every click or every like, or think that you're somehow dictating the conversation or controlling it. You're not, man. You're acting like a dope. And you keep on doing it relentlessly. Man, stop. You're degrading yourself and your rep and your legacy with every one of these posts, likes, or stupid stories. And the worst part is, there's like no sign of this guy stopping. And don't tell me this is some media thing and that the media is making this out to be more than what it really is and that it really is just one quarterback hyping another, because that's not what that is. He's not doing it for anybody else. He's not doing that to tip his hat to Philip Rivers, because he's not doing it for anybody else. He's just doing it for the team that he is rumored to be leaving the Pats for. Look, Tom Brady is pretty smart. Pretty annoying, but pretty smart. He knows how the media works. He knows how to duck. He knows how to dodge questions. He knows how people will respond when he tries to rip his piece of the spotlight. He knows how to avoid attention when he wants to, but he doesn't want to anymore. He wants to keep raising more questions time and time again. He wants you talking about where he might go, whether or not he's going to stay or if he's going to leave. Even though there's nothing new to talk about. I said it last week, I'll say it again. There has not been a more tedious offseason soap opera in the history of the NFL than Tom Brady and his future. Brett Favre's annual indecision. Darrell Revis's holdouts every year. Both were better than this terrible story. And it's nearly impossible to avoid. Like, there's going to come a point where I just stop talking about it. And that point is coming sooner than later. But for the moment, let me just say this. We're talking about a guy who has 6 rings and apparently no life right now. And that is not easy to have or to do. Dude, put your phone down. Like, we get it. You're a free agent. We know. We're just tired of begging you to stay, man. Do what the hell you're going to do. Just do it. Do it. And does anybody really think there's anywhere he would go other than LA, if not New England? I mean, come on, really? It's LA or it's New England, and you have to assume it's going to be New England. So why are we going through all this? Man, put your phone down, dude. Just put it down. We are joined right now by Nick Taylor. Nick, it's good to have you on. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. Thanks for having me on, Jim.
Listen, Nick, good to have you on. Has it sunk in yet? You went wire to wire at Pebble Beach. Has that sunk in yet?
No, I don't think it has. I think my wife and I keep looking at each other, seeing kind of where are we, what's going on. The support from Canada, you know, so many players. It's been overwhelming. So it's been a fun ride.
Yeah, we do have some stations. Yeah. My bad. Go ahead, Nick.
No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You just won at Pebble Beach.
Yeah, it's been, we drove down yesterday, you know, talking to a lot of Canadian media. Everyone's so excited back home. It's every time I feel like myself and any Canadian gets in contention, the support from back home is amazing. There's Canadian golf fans everywhere. It's such a popular sport back in Canada. So there's an overwhelming of support. So it's been, it definitely hasn't sunk in yet, but it's getting closer.
I did not mean to do so. The reason I jumped in, I was going to say that we've got some listeners and some stations in Canada that I know are really excited about that. So I mentioned you went wire to wire to win there. Can you take me back to before the first round? How were you feeling at that point? Did you have a feeling that you might do something special last week?
My game's been pretty good this season, and really for the last year or so, I've always loved the tournaments. I feel like those courses set up well for my game. And playing Monterey the first day is typically the lower of the scores. And I thought, if we get off to a good start, that's the place to do it. And lo and behold, I didn't even play practice at Monterey because there's 3 courses, and just to conserve some energy, didn't play there. And get off the hot start and eagle the first hole and played great the rest of that day and just kept the momentum going. But I felt like my game has been good. You know, I didn't have a great finish at the Waste Manager the week before, but that course really didn't set that well for me. So I wasn't taking many negatives from that. It was just moving on to the next week. So, you know, the game was there. It was just kind of making a few putts at the right time, and it definitely started early on Thursday.
It did start early on. I was going to say you did not wait very long because you opened up with that eagle on 10. What's going through you when you get off to that quick of a start?
you know, keep pushing at that golf course. It's, you know, there's a lot of gettable par fives. It's just a course where if you can get off to a good start there, there's a lot of opportunities. And I just putt great the whole week. That day I made some good putts in that first nine, and I think I was maybe four under that first nine and just kept it rolling. I felt like I just felt so comfortable in the greens for whatever reason last week. Even when they're, you know, Poana greens can get a little bumpy for a reason. My caddy, Skill, and I were just reading the greens great, picking lines, and the ball's going in. So it was one of those weeks.
Nick Taylor joining us. So, Nick, you had that two-shot lead after the first day, but then a lot of times guys get that lead on the first day, then they go back, they go to sleep, they come back the next day, and it all falls apart, yet that's not what happened. You're playing really well, and then you're still the leader going into Sunday, and you're going out with Jason Day in the group in front of you and Phil Mickelson as the pairing in the final group. So what kind of emotions were you feeling as you woke up and you went through your routine on Sunday?
Yeah, I didn't sleep great Sunday night, which I kind of expected. I think, you know, having the lead for three straight days just kind of it can be exhausting to a certain extent. But I feel like I've always been more nervous with the anticipation of, you know, final rounds and that kind of situation. So once I really started warming up, I started feeling more comfortable. And, you know, once we teed off after kind of getting the first tee jitters, I felt pretty comfortable. And again, I made some critical putts that really kind of calmed me down. I had about a 6 or 7 footer for par on the first hole that, you know, to make that, I think, was huge and calming, not to kind of give that lead away on the first hole. And to get out such a great start, Phil and I were, I think, 3 and 4 under, both of us through 6 holes. And I think we just, from then on, we're kind of separating ourselves from the rest of the field. So it almost felt like a match play type scenario. And it was kind of nice that way, that I really only had to worry about kind of what Phil was doing and not worry about the groups ahead of us and just focus on what I was doing, but also what he was doing, and keep it simple.
It's interesting to me, Nick, because the way it was all positioned, right? The Toronto Star headline was Canada's Taylor in Mickelson's way at Pebble Beach, which essentially summed up the idea that everybody expected Phil to win, and it was just a matter of how he was going to win, and then you go out in 32. What were the first 9 holes like for you?
Yeah, it was actually pretty funny. We were embracing the underdog role. It was almost gasps when I was making birdies at front nine. There's a few cheers, and it was from probably my family, and that was about it. It was very, very pro-Phil. You know, they weren't being disrespectful or anything, but they wanted Phil, their man, to win, and I expected that. But I think it was fun to kind of be in that arena of that, of being the underdog. It's not that I've never played with Phil, so it was just exciting that way. And I think building that lead, I feel, even myself, it was, almost you take a step back and you have to almost look at it. You have a 5-shot lead all of a sudden. I think sometimes you can kind of get out of sorts a little bit, but I kind of managed it once we got to 15, luckily, and held on.
We're talking to Nick Taylor for a few more moments. So, Nick, let me ask you this. How would you compare the pressure of playing in the final round of, for instance, the regular season finale in order to keep your card versus the pressure of the back nine at Pebble Beach with Phil Mickelson to get a win?
Yeah, I drew back on that round at Wyndham a couple years ago a lot. It was they're both high pressure but different scenarios. I felt like I was more nervous and had more pressure for that Wyndham round because that was to keep your job, where Sunday was, you know, I was in a great spot. I felt like I was in a good position to have a great week regardless. Again, different pressure, but I think once I felt the most pressure probably once I had that 5-shot lead and let it slip to the 2-shot lead. And that, you know, thoughts are going through your mind of, you know, you lose that lead and don't win. That'll be a tough one to swallow. So two different pressures, but I did definitely draw back on that and use those fives and energy I had to pull through at Wyndham. Help me on Sunday.
Well, a couple of quick things before you go. A couple of big things. Like, your wife, Andy, was not able to be with you for your first win because she was working. This time she was there with you and your 3-month-old son, Charlie. What did it mean to share that moment with them?
Yeah, that was a dream come true. You know, the first win I felt like was a whirlwind. And without her there, it was unfortunate. But it was crazy. It was actually her last shift. She was a social worker in a hospital, still is, but that was her last kind of full shift with her line. And for her to be there, you know, you see it on TV growing up, families coming on the green when someone's a tournament. For that to kind of for us to have that perspective now about that team being the ones, you know, we'll remember forever. Charlie won't, but he'll have pictures to see it.
And Nick, that's a pretty nice paycheck for a nice week of work. What did you guys, how did you celebrate? What did you have for dinner?
So after, you know, a bunch of the media obligations, we were so exhausted. We had a rental house in Pacific Grove with my in-laws and ordered a couple of Domino's pizzas, chilled out, and that was pretty much it. So pretty low-key. We're going to hopefully go with some friends tonight and have a good dinner and celebrate. But, yeah, it was pretty low-key.
I love it. All right, last thought. It opens up the possibility of playing in the Olympics or the President's Cup. How much does that fire you up?
Big time. You know, the Olympics were a huge goal of mine the last year or so when we got closer to it. And, you know, growing up, it wasn't a reality. So now that it is, I think that would be a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I heard so much from friends of mine that had played in it, and just be able to see the other sports, be in the Olympic Village, I think that would be incredible. And I've definitely positioned myself a little bit better than I was to have that opportunity. So I'm looking forward to that. And, you know, President's Cup is now a couple years away, but that's another huge goal. So it's a huge stuff comes along with that win, so I'm excited about it.
Big week. He shot 2-under on Sunday to win the Pebble Beach Pro-Am, a 2-time winner on tour now. As I mentioned, the winner of the 2010 Ben Hogan Award won Washington. Nick Taylor, my guest. Nick, congrats on the win. Great to have you on the show, and I really appreciate that visit.
No problem. Thanks for having me on, Jim.
Let's go to Santa Barbara. Jamie in Santa Barbara. Jamie, what's going on?
Jay Philip Rome. Thanks. My beef is with high school basketball parents in the stands, right? They don't know the rules. They're screaming at the officials. Here are the three things that tick me off the most. 3 seconds, right? You can't have a 3-second call when the shot's in the air. You can't have a 3-second call when the kid is gathering for a shot in the air, right? It wipes the 3 seconds. Know the rules. Also, coach, when you have a 6'7" kid on your team and you're crying to me because you want me to call 3 seconds on the 5'7" point guard, it's not happening, brother. I'm not making that call. And over the back, it's not a thing. You ever hear me call over the back after I report the foul? No, it's a push. It's a push, okay? There is no such thing as over the back. And finally, it's this one, and there's so many different variations of it. Call it both ways, ref. No joke. A couple weeks ago, this mom hollers at me, ref, you got to call it both ways. Lady, we're 45 seconds into the game. You haven't even given me a shot to call it both ways. And then just last week, well, in your neighborhood, I'm at Calabasas High School. It's a tight game. Newbury Park is visiting. They're playing for seedings. Someone in the stand goes, ref, call it both ways. There's 2 minutes left in the fourth quarter. I look up, 8-8. I wish I could just turn around and tell this guy to shut up. Thanks, Rome. I appreciate it.
You got it, Jamie. You feel better? Let's go to the Natty. Logan in Cincinnati. Logan, what's your beef?
Mr. Rome, my beef is when I'm coming home at night and I'm starving and I call my wife and I go, I'm getting food. What do you want? I get nothing. I go, I'll go here. I'll go anywhere you want. She goes, I want nothing. I can call 3 or 4 times. She says, I want nothing. When I get home with my food, she eats all my freaking food.
It's great. All right, Rackham, really quickly, let's go to Dallas. Wrapping the What's Your Beef segment, Matt. Matt, what is your beef?
I got a beef, man. I live downtown. Everybody with a fast car or motorcycle always revs their engine. Why? Nobody cares. That's my beef.
Rackham, nice job, Matt. So he's downtown, right? He's probably like in a loft or a high rise, or he's in town. So you got a bunch of people with muscle cars and fast cars. You got to flex on everybody. And they don't live there, right? They don't care. What do you expect? They're going to buy a fast car and not drive it? They're going to drive buy a loud car and not rev it?
Good night!